This is the Money Talks podcast with Michael Campbell.
Yes, the Trans Mountain Pipeline debate, where civility, common sense, and research goes to die. A vivid illustration of how irrational, how illogical, how insane the Kinder Morgan pipeline expansion debate has become is that, consider, the BC NDP government launched for a second time a legal challenge this past week to the so-called Alberta Shut Off the Taps legislation. BC Premier has made it clear that Alberta better not dare stop sending gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel to BC through the Trans Mountain Pipeline. But at the same time, the same BC government has said it will continue to fight in court and by every other means at its disposal to stop more gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel from Alberta coming through the expanded Trans Mountain Pipeline, where, of course, those products are going to be transported down Line 1 if it's expanded, with more bitumen coming down Line 2. But on the one hand, you want to stop Alberta from saying we're going to shut off the taps, and the other, don't you dare send more product down. Just as noteworthy is that there doesn't seem to be any limit to the amount of taxpayers' dollars the BC NDP government's willing to spend fighting to stop the Kinder Morgan pipeline expansion, which has no chance of succeeding in their court case because the pipeline falls under federal jurisdiction, not provincial. I think I was counting, 17 court challenges, and the project has come out ahead. It passed every regulatory hurdle, including the latest ones. But the BC NDP, with the support of the Green Party, is dying to spend more millions of tax dollars fighting a pipeline that's owned by the Canadian public. And if successful, which as I believe they will not be, but would cost Canadians over $5 billion. The only sure winners here are the lawyers. Illogical, irrational, well, you bet. As others have pointed out, that means Canadians are spending tax dollars to stop a project that they actually own and are defending that same project with tax dollars. And more, it's a project that the majority of Canadians support. I mean, we just got the latest Angus Reid poll this week. 56% support it to 24% against it. In BC, 52% support it, with only 30% saying it's the wrong decision. I love it. That hasn't stopped Premier John Horgan in BC from saying he's reflecting the will of the public. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. And by the way, the polling didn't break down how many of the 30% in BC who oppose the pipeline, or 24% who oppose it nationally, use petroleum-based products. Oh yeah, it's 100%, including every member of the NDP and Green Party. As law professor and writer of Instapundit, one of the most popular blogs on the internet, Glenn Reynolds stated, "I'll believe climate change is a crisis when the people who keep telling me it's a crisis start acting like it's a crisis," which is especially pertinent given the members of parliament's recent overwhelming vote to declare a climate emergency. But as usual, it's never quite a big enough emergency to merit their serious shift in their own personal lifestyles. You know, the more I consider what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said on 60 Minutes earlier this year, that in quotes, "There's a lot of people more concerned about being precisely, factually, and semantically correct than about being morally right." Well, I think that sums up the debate on climate change and on the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion in particular. I mean, who needs to be held hostage by the facts or research when you're morally right? Certainly integrity and open-minded discussion have long since been the casualties of the environmental moral crusade. As Blair King, environmental chemist with a specialty in the assessment of petroleum hydrocarbon contamination, reminds us in quotes, "The role of an activist is to advance their cause, not to advance the truth." And that's why when factual errors are pointed out, activists continue to ignore that. They'll still use them. Anything to advance the story. Of course, they don't like that pointed out and certainly don't acknowledge that when they get the story wrong. But think about this. Have you ever heard a spokesman from Greenpeace, Sierra Club, Tides Canada, you name it, admit that they got any facts wrong? I haven't. But again, as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said, why focus on the facts when you're morally right? But here's the thing. Greenpeace itself summed up their approach when being sued by Resolute Forest Products for claiming that the company was, in quotes, destroying Canada's boreal forest. In their statement of defense, this is Greenpeace itself, they declared that the attacks on Resolute are, in quotes, without question, non-verifiable statements of subjective opinion, at most non-actionable rhetorical hyperbole. Non-verifiable statements, subjective opinion, rhetorical hyperbole, and in other words, BS, without accuracy. And of course, many people are taken in by it, including in the media. And it certainly is a prominent feature of the Trans Mountain Pipeline debate. As Blair King warned, that role of the activist is to advance the cause and not advance the truth. But it's incredible to think that if the Kinder Morgan pipeline expansion was actually canceled, it would result in higher emissions, not lower, because of the increased shipment of oil by rail. But I know, who needs facts? Who needs cost-benefit analysis to assure we're implementing the most effective, cost-efficient policies? Who needs them when you're morally correct? Right now, Michael Levy joins me. Hey, Mike, yesterday in Beijing, there was a Canada Day gala dinner, and I heard you mention this on the air yesterday, and I wanted to come back at it with you. I mean, I'm looking at some of the other issues going on between Canada and China and saying, is there anything that would have said to us, hey, maybe this isn't a good idea to be seen sort of supporting the Chinese regime, even though it's Canada Day celebration at this time?
Mike, I shook my head when I saw this one. This was Canada Day in Beijing. It's a gala dinner. It's a business dinner. It promotes tourism. And the Crown Corporation, Destination Canada, and I'll get to Crown Corporation in a minute, was the principal sponsor. But the lead sponsors included Power Corp, one of the biggest corporations in Canada, Bank of Montreal, Royal Bank, Manulife Financial, and Destination Canada put up $180,000 of taxpayer money to the partnering agreement. Mike, I don't argue that $180,000 wasn't well spent. I argue about with what's going on in China. Here we have a Canadian Crown Corporation who is supporting a dinner in China, the most repressive regime, or one of the most repressive in the world, and with Canada, with their worst, absolutely worst relations since establishing diplomatic relations in 1970. And one more thing, this is after Canada legally arrested Chinese Huawei executive Meng Wanzhou, and in retaliation, the Chinese government has punished Canada economically with suffering trade sanctions and illegally arrested two Canadians and thrown them in jail.
That's the one that just jumped out at me, Mike. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, the trade problems we're having right now, yes, I agree. Would have sort of had my eyebrows raised on this one. But no, the one that sort of crossed the line for me is we got two Canadian citizens. What is it? Michael Kovrig and yes. Michael Spavor, Mike. But right. They've got them on death sentences, for God's sakes, living in deplorable, jailing them in deplorable conditions. I'm wondering how many would have to be in jail before they'd stop this nonsense. You know, okay, we got two. What if it was 12? What if it was 24? I mean, what's the principle in operation here?
Exactly. And Mike, they are not allowed to be in touch with a Canadian embassy. They've had no lawyers. And David Goldstein, who is CEO of Destination Canada, rationalized this by saying China is the biggest source of visitors to Canada after the U.S. and says travelers to Canada from China spent $2 billion in this country last year. Mike, who cares? I mean, when Canadian Tourism Minister Melanie Joly's office, they declined comment when questioned about this, saying the event, it was a Crown Corporation and responsible for their own operational decisions. Well, Mike, I just want to add, before we carry on in this conversation, let's explain for 1 minute a Crown Corp. They're wholly owned by the federal government. Some better known ones are the CBC, Canada Post, Via Rail, Bank of Canada, Canada Pension Plan. The head of the corporations and the directors are all appointed by the government, by the Crown. The Crown sets its budget. They're supposed to be operated at arm's length from government, but overall the government of the day has control by the people they appoint. Well, if they've got control like that, why aren't they stepping in when there's a human rights issue that is so distasteful it makes you want to gag?
Well, I don't think absolutely. And I think what Mr. Trudeau, our prime minister, sets himself up for is he makes these grand statements all the time, about this or that. And then reality sets in. And this one, as I say, it had a real head shaker when I'm thinking of the families and the people, the diplomat and the entrepreneur, handed death sentences, for goodness sakes, but living in terrible conditions. As you just said, Mike, not allowed to speak with representative of the Canadian embassy. Come on. Yep, this one just got my attention, got me going.
Well, me too, Mike. And I, you know, I've got to say, you know, we see the government, we see Trudeau stand up and talk. I mean, today, this morning, our government was talking about human rights in Honduras and that they're going to act on that. In Honduras, look, I have nothing. I have no problem with the government standing up for human rights. But you had Trudeau saying on December 18th of last year on Human Rights Day, I'm quoting, Canada is unwavering in its commitment to protect and promote human rights. Look what happened in China this past 2 weeks with the rioting on the streets when human rights were trampled. Yet two of our own are in prison in China. No contact with lawyers, no contact with embassy, in deplorable conditions. And here's Trudeau saying, Canada is unwavering in its commitment to protect and promote human rights. How about the human rights of two of our own? I just don't get it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, you look at those protests in Hong Kong. Wow, wow, wow. It's the, you know. But anyways, Mike, thank you for ruining my morning.
thank you for letting me get this off my chest, Mike. It's just been bothering me. I mean, I just say shame on Royal, shame on BMO, shame on Power Corp, shame on Manulife, but shame on the Canadian federal government.
Michael Levy will join me next week. Have a great weekend. Very pleased to welcome back Eamon Piercy, CEO of the Piercy Group, but for us, important, author of The 1% Solution, How Small Daily Improvements Produce Massive Long-Term Results. You can get it at Amazon.ca. Eamon, I warned you about this. I wanted to come right back with you and ask you, we got a lot of people getting out of high school now looking for summer jobs. Is there any one tip or couple that come to mind about a summer job?
Yeah, they're great to be on your show again this morning, Mike. Yes, I've got one big tip for those students that want to enter into the workforce and start building a career. It's really important, that first summer job. There was a study done a few years ago tracking 246,000 students from age 15 to 25, and they found that those students that had those summer jobs early on in their career, by the time they were 25 in the workforce, had much better outcomes in terms of skills and salary, et cetera. And you know, the interesting thing about that study is, Mike, it wasn't the job they had as much, it was just the number of hours, just working. So for the students out there that are thinking whether or not they should do it, go for it. That job is critical. And here's the number one tip. If you want to get a great summer job, whether you're a university student, still going through school, or if you're a student about to enter the workforce, call 50 people that you know. Call, connect, email. It's a numbers game. You call virtually everyone you know, and when you call them, you say, my name is so-and-so. I'm looking for a summer job so I can build skills for the future. Do you have any suggestions? So you actually have to connect with people, and it's a numbers game, and that will lead to opportunity.
That alone, though, is such a valuable tip. Certainly the process of doing that. And I've also said, I wasn't, that's a huge study you're talking about, 246,000 following. That's massive. But I've seen other, I remember one from 2 years ago from the Sauder School of Business came out, very much the same results, that I think that getting a summer job fills in the gaps that they're not getting at, in the high school level, when they're, you know, it's very clear the establishment has said their goal is not to necessarily in most cases prepare for a job. But I think you go into the work world, all those things about being on time, some customer relations, some employee teamwork, all of that stuff is so great. So that's really interesting. The other thing jumps out at me, and I just want your take on it. One of the things I see is a mistake for students who do a summer job. They don't get a letter of reference after.
That's right. Yeah, you need, if you've done, no matter what the job is, you've got a letter of reference, you've got contacts for the future, you've got people that can give you suggestions as to where you go next. The other advantage is you get feedback in that job. You actually figure out what you like and what you don't like and what you're good at and what you're not good at as well. But the key is to take that one job and then leverage it to another summer job, then ultimately into a career. I've got three kids. They've gone through great high schools, university, now in the working world. Every one of them worked, and their initial job, you know, may not have looked like it was a career path, but there was something that came out of it that was really helpful. So getting that letter of reference and then keeping that contact is critically important because you're starting to build your career.
And again, what great advice. And one of the things that's coming loud and clear, Eamon, from you, and it comes through in the book, The 1% Solution, how small daily improvements produce massive long-term results. This is an example how some daily focuses, and one of the ones I'm hearing is look past this summer, see it as a building block to next summer, and that's a building block to, you know, careers in a lot of different ways, from contacts to finding out what you like to letters of reference. And I really like that long-term vision that you do the short-term stuff with.
Yeah, people make often they overanalyze, they overthink it. And if you take a really big goal, and the point of that book is to break it right down into small pieces, there's things you can do today or this summer that will lead you to huge opportunities in the future. So don't overthink it, just break it down. And in the book, I give 100 different habits on how to actually do that. It's very practical. It's really suitable for young professionals going into the working world or students. And it's based on my own journey going from the stockroom to the boardroom. So very practical. And getting a summer job is absolutely critical for that student. No matter what your age, just do something to get started. You'll never know where it may lead you to.
Well, the other thing is this, I would say, I throw this in very quickly, we only have a minute left, but I just say, you know, if you're going to apply for a job, know something about the company. And now with the internet, that's never been easier. You know, just if you, let's say it's a fast food restaurant, go look it up on the internet, figure out how big they are. So you can just add that into the conversation. Mm-hmm. And remember, the young people have to know, anybody's got to know that you're in the business of satisfying a need for the employer. Mm-hmm. So those are the kind of things that jump out at me.
Yeah, and don't take no for an answer. I mean, be respectful for sure, but just keep going back over and over, because you're building skills at age 15 that will be super important at age 25.
Oh, I love it. And I would also recommend, go get a copy of The 1% Solution. We don't talk about this stuff enough with our kids. We don't focus enough on it, how small daily improvements produce massive long-term results. Eamon Piercy, as usual, terrific job. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks, Mike. Have a great day.
Time now for the quote of the week. I'm not sure if you know this story, but it goes. The story is more recent because the court case just finished. But the incident happened in 2016. An African American student at Oberlin College in Ohio, his name is Jonathan Aladdin. He was caught trying to steal a bottle of wine from a campus grocery bakery called Gibson's Bakery. Boy, that place had been around for over 100 years, and had been closely tied to the college, well over a century. When the grandson of the owner tried to stop Aladdin, a fight ensued. Police were called. Aladdin and two other students were arrested. But then students, professors, administrators held protests, charging that this was a racist incident. And the bakery had profiled the three students. Aladdin was charged with robbery. The other two were arrested, charged with first-degree misdemeanor assault. But the police investigated, rejected the claims of racial motive, and noted that over a five-year period, the last 5 years, 40 adults have been arrested for shoplifting at Gibson's Bakery. Only 6 were African-American. The court agreed. Ultimately, by the way, all 3 students actually pleaded guilty, but some at the university said it didn't matter. Special Assistant to the President for Community and Government Relations said the guilty plea didn't change a thing. Oberlin went on to bar purchases from the bakery, tried to force other businesses to stop doing business with the bakery. When the owner of the bakery actually met with the college president to say that the university actions were killing his business, instead of sympathy, he was told to stop prosecuting students for shoplifting. Oh, what a lovely lesson there. I mean, there's more to the story, but you're getting the drift. The upshot of the court case, though, was that the actions of key university officials and faculty were viewed by the jury as not just encouraging, but leading the attacks. The result, and this is the thing that's more recent, the bakery was awarded $11 million and another $33 million in punitive damages. What's incredible is despite this massive legal rebuke, university officials are unrepentant. No one's lost their job. And this all brings me to my quote of the week by Jonathan Turley, who's the Shapiro Professor of Public Interest Law at George Washington University. In quotes, "We are reaching a critical point in higher education in the United States where leaders are ceding control to a small group of activist students and faculty members. Too often, those challenges are met not with acts of conscience, but with cowardice. Professors fear being labeled as either insensitive or racist for objecting to protests or changes on campus." End of quote. You know, one of the major observations of this show, which I still haven't seen, I don't think, anywhere else in the Canadian media, is that there is a major price to be paid for allowing extremism to go mainstream. What's happening on many university campuses, you see it in the States all the time, but you also see it in Canada, should be appalling to anyone who believes in free speech and due process. very pleased to welcome back to the show. And what timing on my part, Mark Leibovit, VRTrader.com, the VR newsletters, and I'll get into that in a second. But Mark has been Timer's Digest Timer of the Year, long-term Timer of the Year. And what a great day to bring him on, Gold Market Timer of the Year. Mark, thanks for finding a time.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, Michael. Thank you for having me right here on the summer solstice, too.
There you go. Well, let me come at you with the gold. I mean, come on, that's got to be one of the big investment stories of the last month or so. 1,400 seems like a magic number. What does your work tell you about it?
Okay, well, when we were on in March, I told you I was looking for a test or breakout above that 1370, yeah. And the seasonal low, you know, was probably due early summer, and it came here, and obviously in early June and late May, and here we are. So if you're looking at the charts, you know, you got to decide if you're a trader or you're an investor. As a trader, you know, we're long a bunch of stuff in our gold letter, and, you know, my temptation is to start ringing the register a little bit here if it continues to push any higher, because these things zig and zag. I mean, gold could be 1,400 and back to 1,350, and we can trade it too. So I'm studying the numbers here, and there's some gaps to the upside that might be filled if you're a technician. So, you know, I'm looking at the charts, but it sure looks like the trend is overall higher, and I'm trying to give it the benefit of the doubt, but, you know, I don't want to be sitting here predicting, as I did in March, the possibility of 1,500. I don't know if that's happening or not this year, but for the moment, the bulls are in charge. It looks okay. As a trader, I might be inclined to, you know, like I say, ring the register here just to take some trades that we've been sitting with for 2 or 3 months, you know?
Well, I think it's important also you're making that distinction. I still find, and I know I chat with Victor Adair about this all the time, is how people, even long-term investors and things, but somehow their psychology becomes too short-term. You know, and so that distinction between what a trader is going to do in the marketplace and what a longer-term investor are going to do is very important. I know many who are now accumulating in the gold and silver market, for example, they're not worried about this week's up or down or next week's up or down or next month. They're looking at a 3-4 year time horizon on this. And then, as you say, even though you predicted this correctly in March, but as a trader, as a trading service, you may just back off a little bit if the numbers don't go your way.
Right, particularly if volume starts to slow to the upside and everybody gets, you know, too exuberant. You know, everybody was pretty bearish on gold. I think in March when we were on the show, I was mentioning, I'd love to buy it around that 1250, 1270 area that got down there. And yeah, here we are already up at 1400. So this is important to me at VR Trader. And again, you know, we're not making long-term investments in our service, though we do talk about the cyclical picture in the longer term, as you know, over the years. Bottom line is you got to learn when to ring the register. Listen, if you want to be a long-term holder in gold, you've suffered quite a bit, as you know, except in Canadian dollars in recent months. But, you know, you got to be aggressive. So anyway, the trend seems to be okay, but we're going to be trading.
Yeah, I also thought that it was significant, though, that gold started its move while the U.S. dollar was still strong. Obviously, it's maintained it while there's a little more weakness in the U.S. dollar. You know, but as you mentioned, Canadians, and this is one of the key lessons on Money Talks, is always, you know, what currency are we talking about? In Canada, it hasn't been near as painful. I mean, we're you know, I think we're within shouting distance of a brand new high, you know, if this keeps going at this point. We'll have to see, of course, but it's been better in Canadian dollars. Let me just, can you give me a quick hit on silver?
Silver is disappointing. I own this ETF, ticker symbol CEF, and it's half silver, half gold, and it's been moving up, but it really hasn't performed here. I thought silver would start to take off here a little bit more than it has. We're long, and we own a couple names like First Majestic Silver and so forth, but I would say basically disappointing, but I'm not going to sell it. I think at some point it should catch up. So at the moment, it's a big question mark in my mind why it's not participating. I guess the real hedge for those who worry about worldwide catastrophes and the Iranian situation and interest rates and all the things that we seem to worry about all the time, gold seems to be the place investors want to be. That's the only rationale I can give you at the moment. So it's starting to break out a little bit. It doesn't have the momentum, but we're holding.
You know, Mark was the guy, and then Jim Dines after Mark, telling me about the marijuana sector years ago. And told our audience too, every time since. And he does the VR Canna Sector Report, and that looks at the cannabis, hemp, marijuana related stocks. You know, it's great stuff. But one of the things Mark doesn't know is we've been talking to his office this past week, and we asked if they would give us a bit of a summer special here. So listen to this. The VR Canna Sector Report, you get the Trading Ace, a separate service, a VR Blockchain Letter, which I'm going to talk about blockchain in a minute, VR Metals Resource Letter, all of that. It's about $334 regularly, but listen to this. Go to moneytalks.net, Mike's Money Talks, mikesmoneytalks.ca, and you can get the next 60 days of all of these for $25. Then if you want to renew, it's an auto-renew, you get a 50% discount after that. So it automatically, and of course, if you want to cancel, just give them a call or email them, and you're going to cancel before the 60-day trial period ends. But still, it's 60 days for $25. It's incredible. And then you get, of course, a 50% discount. Just go to moneytalks.net, because all the stuff that we're covering here today, of course, I've covered in the newsletters. But I've got to get on to the next one, which is, Mark, let's talk about, there is so much I want to get to, because you do the blockchain letter. I've got to get to that in a second. But the cannabis sector right now, give us a quick take.
Okay, we're in a corrective phase in cannabis. And Friday, of course, the big one, you know, Canopy Growth had a big sell-off on earnings disappointment, but basically we topped out in April on a cyclical basis here, and we're still in a little bit of a downward correction in the sector. There's always the star performers day to day. We're still bullish, you know, on the intermediate to longer term, but on a short term basis, there's no clear sign of a bottom yet. We are nibbling at a few things because there's some bargains, but just as a caution, you know, we've been in about a 3-month correction here, and you know, sometimes you get 3 to 6 months corrections in this sector. It's very volatile. And at the moment, we're overall bullish, but as traders, we're waiting for a little more confirmation of a bottom. It could come as early as Monday as well, so we're watching the technicals. A bull, but, you know, as the people who are invested know, we've been in a bit of a downtrend, and this is just part and parcel to the sector.
Well, with your Canna Sector report, that's when you look at the timing. I mean, that's when you'll give your subscribers a sort of the all clear when you see better numbers coming your way. So at this point, you're sort of keeping an eye on it with an eye to again seeing a more upward movement. But that's exactly what you do in the Canna Sector report.
Right, we trade a little bit too, Michael. You know, I can't get that trader. instinct out of me. For example, we jumped into one name, Tilray, on I think it was 2-3 days ago, and we're up like 4 points or 5 points in that stock. Just as a trade, we may decide to trade it, but it's so cheap compared to where it's been. As you may recall, it got as high as $300 a share within the last year, and it got down into the 40s. So, but you know, we do trade a bit, but for the most part, you know, the sector is okay. Just have to you know, watch it day to day, and there's going to be a lot of news and a lot of volatility, a lot of new issues coming out, a lot of IPOs in the area too, which is sort of diluting it a little bit. Investors can only be in so many investments, obviously. So the more IPOs, more offerings we have, and the more choices, it's going to be a little bit more difficult, you know, to make money on the big names.
Let me come to blockchain for a sec, because I know, you know, it's related because you follow Bitcoin. You were the one I remember just before the big move in Bitcoin, again, off the top of my head, you were again at the Outlook conference, and Bitcoin won sort of your big recommendation, and it was at like $2,000, and it went to 20 within before the next Outlook conference, 20,000. Right. I mean. But let's talk about blockchain a little bit, and if we can talk about Bitcoin, because it's had a big move, but maybe on to the other cryptos.
Okay, well, you know, our big play here is the GBTC, which is the Bitcoin Investment Trust. We talked about that, I think, 3 months ago when we were on the air. And, you know, this thing has moved up nicely. Now it's over $1,350 a share. It sort of mirrors the move in Bitcoin itself, which, as you know, is starting to approach that 10,000 level. I'm bullish. The chart is bottomed. It looks like it's going higher. I can't tell you if Bitcoin's going to 20,000 or higher right away. That possibility does exist because there's been just so much bearishness. Everybody gave up on it as if it's going to go to zero. And the charts say we've had a multi-week, multi-month bottom here. So the blockchain letter covers all kinds of you know, cryptocurrencies, and I sort of like to focus on the Bitcoin because that seems to be the more popular favorite. But the safer way to play it is just buy the stock, is why I sort of like it, because you can track the volume, you can do the charting on it. It's a lot easier than the individual cryptos. But take a look at GBTC on any pullback. This thing is around 13. This could be, you know, $18, $20, $25. It has that potential.
Yeah, when you were recommending that to our audience, I think it was back in March, my goodness, we're up a ton since that.
Yeah, it's made a nice move here, Mike. It's gone from like $4 to $14 in the last 8 or 9 months. It's a nice little move. It mirrors the move in Bitcoin. But the reason I focus on that, because that sort of is the big pack leader. You know, if Bitcoin is moving, all the small ones start to move, and all the interest is generated around that. If Bitcoin didn't do well, I don't think the others will. So what the bottom line I'm saying is Bitcoin and cryptos are not dead, and there's going to be a lot of action, and they scared a lot of people out, and it's an international event. It's not just a flash in the pan. So if you go to our blockchain letter, you can see a lot of alternatives to the GBTC there.
And let me finish with this. I maybe should have started with it, but I'm so interested about the gold move, but give me the overall market analysis as we come into summer.
Choppy as usual in the summer, you know, and possibility of a pullback into the fall before we get the big year-end rally. As I mentioned in March, I'm overall bullish. We did see the S&P into new highs here, as you know, in the past week, but the other indexes didn't really confirm, but I'm not too worried about it. I mean, we get this choppy period here. We could see a pullback, you know, into July or August and then back up again. So it's going to be a trader's market. But my basic view is new highs into the end of the year. And like anything, you got to trade them. And there's a lot of opportunity in individual stocks along the way. You know, obviously looking out into next year and the election here in the U.S., there's going to be a lot of other variables to think about, whether if Donald Trump gets reelected or not, what that would do for the markets. So we'll have to worry about that, obviously, in the months ahead. But I think we're okay into year end, and I still think you'll see all the indexes into new highs. As I mentioned in March, Mike, I know we're probably running out of time. You know, if you take a bigger picture view, you know, how high can this market go before we finally get one of those big shakeouts? And my gut feeling now, as I said 3 months ago, is we may be looking at 5 or 10% higher overall in the market in the next 6 months or year. But the downside risk could be that 30% if we start getting some negative news. So we got to be aware of that as a long-term investor, you know.
And, of course, you'll be obviously monitoring on a momentary basis. I was going to say daily. No, it's momentary with this. Mark Leibovitz at VRTrader.com. But here's the thing. Back to this. Go to moneytalks.net. Take advantage of this great opportunity because you can get the VR, you know, it's the cannabis report, basically, the trading ace report, the blockchain letter, and VR Metals resource letters. That's $334 regularly. What you do is you sign up for 60 days. You get for $25. I mean, that's incredible. And then it would auto remove at a 50% discount. And then if you want to cancel, you do cancel, but go ahead. But I think you're going to enjoy this. It's a great value. Mark, once again, I always appreciate you finding time for us. Great stuff.
Thank you, Michael. Looking forward to seeing you in February. Thanks for having me.
Last week, Prime Minister Trudeau announced the ban on single-use plastics in the medical sector that may have, you know, syringes, pill bottles, diagnostic equipment, that kind of stuff. I mean, it's a valuable part. No, it was part of the Prime Minister's declaration to ban single-use plastics by 2021, but that would be included unless there's changes. I mean, Canadians who love simplistic solutions to complex problems, of course, cheered. Although, to be fair, in keeping with what's now a defining characteristic, I suspect most of us didn't really think very thoroughly on this. It sounded good, though. After all, who wants plastic in the ocean? Choking marine life. And when banning single-use plastics are proposed, I think most people just think of plastic bags. Although a moment of research would reveal they make up a small portion of it. But even if every country banned plastic bags, it wouldn't make much of a difference because they make up less than 1% of the plastics that's currently afloat in the world's ocean. And of course, I mean, it's immeasurable how little comes from Canada. I mean, keep in mind, the majority of our plastic waste ends up in landfills, not the ocean. But again, most of us salute the ban of single-use plastic bags in the Western countries. But you got to remember also that Western countries, it's only 5% of the land-based plastic waste in the oceans. As Bjorn Lomborg points out, half of it comes from four countries alone: China, Indonesia, Philippines, Vietnam. Saw it firsthand myself last June when I was in those countries. In the Globe and Mail, though, Lomborg goes on to make life even more uncomfortable for the simple set. Which brings me to my stat of the week, with the not-so-startling revelation that if we don't use plastic bags, we're going to use something else. A new study in California found that the plastic bag ban eliminated 40 million pounds of plastics, but also saw an increase in trash bags by 12 million because a lot of people just reuse that shopping plastic bag and put it in the garbage can, and that becomes theirs. I do it myself. So you saw a big jump in the purchasing of trash bags. Also, a doubling of the use of paper bags. It doubled to 83 million pounds, and that led to higher emissions. So think about that. It's not just so simple as saying, I'm banning plastic bags. What are you going to do instead? But, you know, we've known all this for a while. In 2008, the UK Environment Agency published a study of resource expenditures for various bags, paper or plastic, canvas, recycled tote bags, that kind of stuff. It included that consumers seeking to minimize pollution. It concluded that consumers seeking to minimize pollution and carbon emissions should use, are you ready, a plastic grocery bag and then reuse those bags at least once as trash can liners or for other secondary tasks. You know, last year, a study by the Danish Ministry of Environment and Food that I mentioned on this show a year ago, and this is truly a shocking stat, when they took into account plastic waste, emissions, climate change damage, ozone depletion, among other indicators, it concluded, think about this, all motherhood, the organic cotton shopping bag, it would have to be used 20,000 times before it'll have less environmental damage than a plastic bag. Let's say you took a cotton shopping bag and used it twice every week. It would still take 191 years before the overall environmental effect of using the cotton bag is less than if you just used plastic and used it once for trash. Paper bag, 33 reuses, which is kind of tough if it's paper, but 43 reuses for it to be better than a single-use plastic bag. And just like the study concludes that a simple plastic bag reused as a trash bag has the smallest environmental of all the other choices. And I think that'll shock a lot of people because they haven't looked at it closely enough. And I know many won't care. Studies and facts have no place in the environmental politics where pandering to the most superficial thinker seems to be the winning strategy. But I ask you to chomp on those numbers. Ozzie Jurek joins me on the line right now. Ozzie, you know, last week you mentioned this to us, and it was about, and it really had a lot of response, that we better be careful. If you're building, say, a laneway house, or maybe you're doing Airbnb, or maybe you're renting a room, you may be setting yourself up for an extra tax burden, at least on that portion, because you won't qualify for the primary residence. And it just got me thinking, my goodness, of course. I mean, that's where people have their money. That's why governments are focused on getting more money out of people's real estate.
Yeah, and they're drooling at the prospect. You know, look at all the untaxed capital gain that could be taxed. Well, Mike, I was never for the laneway house from the point of view, if you put it on a 33-foot lot, you lose your backyard. And the person that lives there, I mean, it's not exactly a great vista from my front door among the garbage cans and the laneway and the trucks going by and so on. But what people don't realize is that you build a laneway home for a little extra income, and now you've complicated your life in ways you just did not think about. Because from a tax perspective, the laneway house is not a separate property. It can't be transferred, for instance, to a corporation or so on. So if it's rented, first of all, you may have to pay GST and other tax considerations. You've got to talk to your accountant. You've got to figure out that it costs you $350,000 to $500,000. And then if it's 33% occupying now the laneway house off your total property and you make $1 million profit, happy you, well, 33% may now be capital gain taxable. And you hadn't bargained for the cost versus the income plus the cost of the taxes. And now I'm not an accountant. You have to sit down with your accountant and work it out. But my goodness gracious, be careful. If you have an office in your home, some people apparently use a capital cost allowance, a depreciation. The moment you do that, you've changed your tax position according to CRA. And so this, we want to make an extra little bit of income. We want to help, you know, the city grow and accommodation, and then we have these unintended consequences.
Well, and as I say, I'm worried about Airbnb too, because you've turned that part of your home into a business. So it's, easily they can come along and say, sorry, you're going to have to pay capital gains, at least on that portion that you were renting out.
Well, that's right. And of course, you're now being assessed. Government knows what you own. And the city of Vancouver actually has introduced a bylaw that requires you to obtain a business license. And it states that a landlord can only rent out their principal residence, right? So not you can't have a rental property that you do B&B. But if a resident is already rented to a tenant, then the tenant, may create a short-term rental, right? So now, of course, yes, you have designated yourself to have a in your principal residence, you have a an income portion that is business. I'm not saying what it is or isn't, but it's time to sit down with a very smart accountant to take a look with the view that you and I hold, that government will always act in favor of themselves.
Well, and again, yeah, and that's what I want to bring to people's attention is that governments are desperate for money. I mean, they're going to be even more desperate with unfunded pension liabilities. That's why I talk about them. You saw the debt numbers coming out of the Parliamentary Budget Office yesterday. I mean, they want the money. And that's why you're seeing property tax increases every year, other things. But I'm saying that look at British Columbia as an example where the provincial government, again, you know, somebody buys a home and owns it for 20 years. It doesn't matter. They said that's speculation in certain areas if it's not your primary residence. Yeah. But others, they said, if it's worth over $3 million, they're rubbing their hands together. You're not allowed to do that without paying us more, which is basically what they said. I mean, the lack of respect for personal property after tax purchases of it, so you've already paid a big chunk in taxes, then you get it and they say, nope, not still enough. That's what I think is happening here.
Well, that's the thing. If you have 68% of British Columbians own their own home, they're not sort of the minority. And we are prudent homeowners. They're working hard to over time, you pay it off, and when you retire, you have an asset for your family. You've created wealth. And it seems to be that particularly our local government actively and successfully is making us all poorer, right? I mean, yeah. Depending on who you listen to, we've lost somewhere around 80 to 90 billion already, 5,000 properties not being built. The big thing is the jobs are being lost. It seems to be that they're attacking not just government, also all the in internal special interest groups. They're attacking pipelines and mining and construction. These are all jobs that pay over $100,000. They may have high employment, but it's mostly now in the service industry. So what's happening is that government will be running out of money, and hey, they're going to come after all of our assets.
Hey, give me a hot property to cheer me up.
Well, we got a great lakefront cabin in Alexis Creek. It's just about west of Williams Lake. It's on almost an acre, 1,000 square feet, comes furnished tools and other equipment. There's only 12 cabins on this lake, so it's a neat little place, and it's on at $129,000.
Well, I'm going to go hide there. Hey, Ozzie, one last thing. Thanks so much for your help with Special Olympics this week. Ozzie, of course, was at the tournament, also sponsors at the tournament, too. Always there. Tony Neumeyer with you. Great to see him again. So many things, but just a big thanks, Ozzie, for a great event.
Well, the big thanks really belongs to you. I mean, you really run it well. And I just live for you bidding against your own wife, or rather she's bidding against you on your auction item. I mean, you haven't lived if you haven't seen this.
Oh, thanks for bringing that up. Victor Dare joins me live from the trading desk. Vic, you heard Mark Leavitt earlier. I just wanted to get your quick take on gold.
Well, I did. So gold, what do we got? A 6-year high this week at $1,415. That's up $140 or 10% from where we were just over 3 weeks ago. The jump in gold, I believe, is way more than was justified by the weakness that we saw in the U.S. dollar. And that's usually the flip side of gold. So I have to think that the rally in gold was very much due to geopolitical stress, let's just call that the U.S.-American geopolitical stress, the U.S.-Iranian, rather, speculating buyers that stampeded into a market they'd been previously ignoring. We had the open interest, that's the number of players, as it were, in the gold market in Chicago jump 30% in 3 weeks. The wow. Other thing, we have had a very sharp decline in real interest rates. And the from the notes I have on my website this week, I started by saying that the irresistible force that has moved all markets the past couple of months has been this increasingly aggressive repricing of future interest rate expectations. So we had a culmination of that this week with both the ECB and the Fed indicating to markets that they're going to be easing more. Well, the market was way ahead of them. We've been pricing this in for some time,
yeah.
But it was almost like this parabolic rush to the upside in bond prices, I think, topped out this week, but it rippled across all markets, and certainly the gold market got part of that reaction, you know, priced into the gold rally. But the really, really big thing with gold was the geopolitical stress. I mean, the market was expecting some retaliation from the states. In a way, thank God Trump backed away from that. And now we've got the gold up at six-year highs. You don't want to be short here, I don't think, but it's had a very big move in a very short period of time.
Well, it's interesting. Ross Clark sent me a stat that gold took in more than $1.5 billion on Friday. That was its largest one-day take ever. You know, that's quite something.
Yeah,
you know,
I saw Ross's work there. The bullish sentiment on gold is 95%. That is at least an eight-year high.
Wow.
You know, it's kind of obvious. The market had been ignored for a long time. All of a sudden, it caught the eye of speculators. There's been a real rush into that market. Let me just put another side on that. The bond market, so far this year in the States, $130 billion. That's the people putting money into bond funds. So there's been just, you got this capital that rushes around from one thing to the other, and it can just really move these markets. So we had a lot of capital flow into gold and the resulting very sharp rally in the price.
Well, I felt also that there was so much focus on 1362 as a number, 1360, whatever.
Oh, yeah.
We got through that, and then, man, did the money start pouring in quickly. You know, but based on that, not on the fundamentals at all. Let me just very quickly, time, we only got a minute, I'm sorry, but U.S. dollar, though, I think still holds the key. And you called that interest rate thing, by the way, last year. You were very clear. You said, I'm always looking for what's going to surprise the market. This is way back in October, and you said, I think interest rates are going down. I think that's what the surprise would be. Well, we're here now.
Yeah, well, then to go to the U.S. dollar, we've had it trade to a two-year high at the end of May. Started to feel a little toppy to me. Certainly, the Fed saying that they are going to dramatically lower, or indicating, I should say, that they may, if conditions warrant, dramatically lower interest rates. That's bearish the U.S. dollar. We backed up a bit here. If this is the turn in the U.S. dollar, that's going to be really important to a lot of markets.
Yeah.
But, you know, the case isn't made yet, but the U.S. dollar definitely falling back here to about a three-month low, I think, after hitting two-year highs in May.
Well, nothing's discouraged me from my long-term view that it's still a bull market. I haven't seen any numbers that say it's not a long-term bull market for the U.S. dollar. Victor, you'll be here to chronicle for it. I hope you go out and have a terrific weekend. And again, our thanks for your help with Special Olympics. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mike. And I will be on the talking with you later this year over here in Vancouver Island. We're going to have our big fundraising event for Special Olympics in September. I'll tell everybody about that so they can be prepared and come out and help the folks over here.
That'd be terrific.
Thanks, Mike.
Time now for this week's Goofy Award. About a month ago, it was found out that Elections Canada was going to hire a group of what they called influencers on social media in an effort to get a higher turnout from people, especially in the 18 to 34 age group. The program was budgeted to cost $650,000. Not sure if you heard about this. Elections Canada, though, not off to a good start, refused to give the criteria for how they selected the group, the names chosen to be those influencers on social media. That's not going to foster trust, and it certainly didn't, because the fears were it's going to be partisan. I mean, after all, Elections Canada, I think, blew it when they gave $975,000 to the Assembly of First Nations in 2015 with the purpose of getting, again, more people in the Indigenous communities to vote. And the stipulation was clearly that it was supposed to be strictly nonpartisan. Unfortunately, many of the Assembly of First Nations leaders did not comply and made highly partisan speeches, in this case against the Harper government, calling for a change in government. No, that did not work out. So not a surprise that the latest campaign by Elections Canada was greeted with a lot of cynicism, which is only increased by the refusal to lift the criteria and the names of those people selected. But don't worry. They had their media apologists in the CBC and the Canadian press who went after, well, especially the Conservatives, who criticized, of course, the program. They were worried they were going to be the targets. Election Canada, though, was pressured finally to releasing the names. And listen to this. It literally took just minutes to expose that many of the chosen influencers were anything but nonpartisan, despite the claim by Election Canada that they'd been thoroughly vetted. I don't care which party was in power, which is doing, this is not what Elections Canada is supposed to do. I thought it was incompetent, because it didn't take long to expose. A quick search found that public statements about the Prime Minister from this group of influencers included things like the ideal man, another called him a champ, One declared he was a he had a celebrity aura and glow. One declared his man crush. One also referred to former prime minister as Stephen Hitler. I mean, this is not the talk of partisans. They're allowed to do that. But why is Elections Canada pushing that? Come on, it was either extreme bias or gross incompetence. But that wasn't the goofy enough part. Elections Canada, under the pressure when it's so blatant that these people were partisan, canceled the program this week. I mean, the partisanship was too blatant to ignore. I can hear you say, fair enough. No, here's the kicker. They'd already paid out most of the $650,000 of our tax dollars to the so-called influencers for nothing before any work was done. If you even call that work, by the way. And now, oh yeah, they're going to try and get it back. Some of it back. No. We're kissing that money goodbye. You know what? You can't make this stuff up. Go to mikesmoneytalks.ca, please. Every day you can hear the daily business comment. Join us on Mike's Money Talks on Facebook, all of that. I hope you go out and I hope you enjoy the first official weekend of summer.
Subscribe to the Money Talks with Michael Campbell podcast for free at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or anywhere you get your on-demand audio. For the complete show, daily podcasts, and more.